Today is Friday, December 2nd. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of our newscast and podcast on the internet.
Good evening. It's 5:09 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
Also today, we shall be interviewing Professor Chris Erickson, who's here right here in our studio, and we will be talking to him about the Occupy movement, as well as recent events of police brutality across the states. So stay tuned for that. All that and more right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing.
You're listening to News 101, your source for independent news. And now for our local headlines.
First Nations group, the Gitsan, in northwestern BC, has agreed to take a stake in the contentious Northern Gateway project. In a statement made this Friday, Hereditary Chief Elmer Derrick said, "Over time, we have established a relationship of trust with Enbridge. We have examined and assessed this project, and we believe it can be built and operated safely. We believe that the construction of this pipeline is of vital importance to the future of Canadian energy security and prosperity," end quote. The announcement comes a day after Enbridge said that First Nations opposition to the project was not unanimous and that the company was talking to communities that were interested in taking a stake in the project. Enbridge has agreed to provide up to 10% equity in the project to eligible communities and has also agreed to provide financing to communities to allow them to take advantage of the offer. That statement by Enbridge was in response to statements made on Thursday by First Nations leaders in Vancouver, where they gathered to sign the Save the Fraser River Declaration, opposing the proposed 1,200-kilometer-long, $5.5 billion petroleum pipeline project. So far, more than 61 First Nations leaders have signed the declaration. The declaration bans tar sands oil pipelines in Fraser River watersheds and also prohibits tankers from using the migratory routes salmon used returning to the Fraser River.
With all of Vancouver's emergency shelters filled to capacity, Mayor Gregor Robertson urged the provincial government Thursday to open 4 currently closed winter shelters for the homeless. Robertson said, quote, "The BC government has to open more winter shelters in Vancouver to ensure people aren't forced to sleep outdoors at night and endangering themselves in this weather," end quote. However, Housing Minister Rich Coleman has said his ministry has already made arrangements for beds to be opened in the event of extreme cold weather. But Coleman did confirm Robertson's statement that the province will not reopen 4 city-owned winter shelters at a cost of $1.5 million this winter. Coleman says the current situation doesn't warrant reopening these shelters. Judy Graves, Vancouver Homelessness Housing Coordinator, said she is grateful for the Housing Ministry's arrangements, but says that the majority of the new social housing units went to people already off the street, not homeless people. She says the city's still needs government funding for at least 92 temporary beds, preferably in shelters outside the downtown core.
On a similar note on housing development projects, on Thursday, social housing advocates in the downtown east side received a message of support from Canadian author and activist Naomi Klein. Klein spoke at a demonstration in front of the Pantages Theatre demolition site on East Hastings Street, where a proposed development has been drawing opposition from a coalition of downtown east side organizations. Klein told demonstrators, which included downtown east side residents and Occupy Vancouver participants, that she supported the demand of action for no condo development in a low-income neighborhood. Here's a clip of what she said at the demonstration.
Well, we're having little technical difficulties here, but all right, the clip is coming right up. One second. This is Naomi Klein speaking to demonstrators at the downtown east side.
This action, which is for no condo development on the downtown east side. It's a clear demand, it's a fair demand, it's a moral demand. I was privileged to attend the signing ceremony this morning that Harsha mentioned. It was incredibly moving. To be there at the anniversary of the Save the Fraser Declaration, saying no to Enbridge pipelines and to tankers. And there were many speakers, many chiefs spoke, and they talked about what this resource extraction model means to them. A loss of culture, a loss of land, displacement. That is what people are afraid of. Where are people displaced? Two, they're displaced to here. And now they're being displaced again. That's what we're hearing, being displaced again. Two, as Harsha said, the real housing policy is prisons, including private prisons, so that you can make some more money off of incarceration after you make money off of gentrification.
Naomi Klein also made points about gentrification in the downtown east side. Here is a clip of what she had to say at that point.
Gentrification doesn't just drive housing up in this, housing prices up in this neighborhood. It drives the cost of everything up in this neighborhood. And it drives the cost of everything up across the city. And this is the model that's being put forward. So I think it's really important to challenge this idea that Canada doesn't have any problems, that we're so much better than the United States. This is the part of the country that nobody wants to look at.
That's right.
Right? We know that. And, you know, there was so much anger at Occupy Vancouver, anger at seeing homelessness, anger at seeing drug addiction and mental health problems. They just wanted to sweep it away, bring it back to the downtown east side. That's what they were saying. But now on the downtown east side, they're trying to sweep it away from here. So this is a disgrace. This is a disgrace, and I'm proud to be with you saying no, drawing the line. There's been a lot of drawing the lines today, and as Harsha said, people said we're going to put a wall up, we're not going to let your pipelines through, and I'm so proud to be with you today saying we're not going to let your condos through either.
That was Canadian author, activist, and journalist Naomi Klein speaking to demonstrators opposing the project that have been calling for a moratorium on condo development in the downtown Eastside area and for the construction of social housing. Klein also joined activists and First Nations groups at the Rio Theatre last night for a public forum to discuss the threat of oil pipelines and supertankers. That oil pipelines and supertankers pose in BC.
Two Fresh Slice franchises have been fined $44,000 for employing illegal staff. The two downtown Vancouver locations have been employing foreign nationals since March of 2011. The Canadian Border Services Agency's investigation led to the charges against Bahman Afshari, who has pleaded guilty to 7 counts.
A latest analysis by Canadian credit bureau TransUnion shows that British Columbians still have more consumer debt than anyone else in the country. But they're also starting to pay it off much faster. TransUnion is a credit bureau that maintains a national consumer credit database. On Thursday, their quarterly analysis of Canadian credit trends found that debt levels across the country are beginning to level off after more than 6 years of climbing, but only BC and New Brunswick have had total balances go down year over year. The average BC resident has $36,000 on average in mortgage debt, in non-mortgage debt, sorry, 43% higher than the Canadian average of $25,000. Thomas Higgins, TransUnion's Vice President of Analytics and Decision Services, said the high debt levels in BC and Alberta are a reflection of the two provinces' more robust economies and higher standards of living.
Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Morgan Yee. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the national news.
The Canadian Red Cross has announced they will provide aid to the Attawapiskat, about 500 kilometers north of Timmins, Ontario, after a state of emergency was declared due to the poor living conditions. Many families have been living in shacks with no heating, plumbing, or electricity. The Canadian Red Cross will be providing community members with blankets, space heaters, winter clothing, and insulated sleeping mats, among other necessary items. The federal government has also pledged $500,000 to the community for funding. However, local MP Charlie Angus has said that the money will not be enough when a house in the region can cost up to $200,000. Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada says that this has provided the area with $3 million for housing in 2011 to 2012, and that local government must provide the funds.
A Nova Scotia man was sentenced to 18 months in prison for aggravated sexual assault after pricking holes in his girlfriend's condoms. Craig Hutchinson, 41, had been dating a woman for several months in 2006 when she wanted to end the relationship. He poked holes in her condoms, hoping that if she got pregnant, she would stay with him. After getting pregnant, she had an abortion, which resulted in an infection of her uterus. Hutchinson then told her what he had done, prompting her to call the police, who charged him with aggravated sexual assault. Although Hutchinson was acquitted in 2009, the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal ordered a new trial, at which point he was convicted.
Today, the City of Calgary has asked a judge to order the eviction of Occupy protesters camping at Olympic Plaza. The remaining occupiers were served with court orders on November 23rd. The city is seeking an injunction to have the protesters removed from the public park and barred from setting up camp anywhere else in the city. Protesters have been occupying the plaza since October. A woman who has been listed as missing since 1993 has been found in Victoria, BC. Her mother, Patricia O'Byrne, is accused of abducting her when she was only 20 months old. Her father, Joe Chisholm, has not seen her for 18 years and says he thinks the issue, quote, can be talked through.
Those are your national headlines. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the international news.
In a report released yesterday, the Government Accountability Office in the United States stated that a recent study found that hundreds of foster children were prescribed five or more mind-altering drugs and thousands were prescribed doses higher than the maximum dosage. Many of the combinations of these medications, as well as the high levels prescribed, are considered too dangerous even for adults. In some cases, infants under 1 year of age were prescribed psychotropic drugs, possibly leading to severe side effects. The release of the study concluded a year-long ABC News investigation of the foster care system in Massachusetts, Michigan, Oregon, and Texas over a period of 2 years. Foster children in Texas were 53 times more likely to be prescribed five or more of these medications, 19 times in Massachusetts, 15 times in Michigan, and 13 times in Oregon. Drugs prescribed include antidepressants, antipsychotics, anti-anxiety medication, and mood stabilizers. Some of these were prescribed off-label for conditions unapproved by the FDA and were sometimes prescribed to children who did not have a condition in the first place, according to ABC.
An Afghan rape victim who was jailed in 2009 for adultery has been freed without having to marry her attacker, her lawyer has told the BBC. Although the woman's attacker was jailed for the crime, she also faced charges. She became pregnant as a result of the rape and gave birth in a Kabul prison. Her release is due in part to a petition which was signed by 5,000 people, and her case, quote, has served to highlight the plight of Afghanistan women, said Rigoras Usakas, the EU's ambassador and special representative to Afghanistan.
Those are your international headlines. For more international headlines, we shall go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton wrapped up her visit at the home of Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. It was the highest-level U.S. visit to Myanmar in decades. Both women addressed a small gathering outside where Suu Kyi said the country needed capacity building and technical assistance from the international community and welcomed the World Bank to assist.
If we go forward together, I am confident that there will be no turning back from the road towards democracy. We are not on that road yet, but we hope to get there as soon as possible with the help and understanding of our friends.
Suu Kyi also called for the release of political prisoners. An Afghan woman named Gulnaz, who was raped by a married man and then jailed for adultery after the attack, will be freed from prison with no preconditions. This is what Gulnaz's lawyer, Kimberly Motley, said after multiple international news sources reported her release was contingent upon her marrying her rapist. Motley spoke to Al Jazeera, saying the pardon establishes a precedent.
To me, that's a message that what happened to her, with her being charged with adultery in the first place, is wrong. And also, President Karzai also is telling them to look at the files of all the women, as I understand it, at least in Kabul, and also to talk to all the women that are in prison in Kabul to find out what happened to them in court. So it definitely is a step in the right direction.
Gulnaz's story first gained attention after she was featured in an unreleased EU documentary about women's rights. A Sudanese-born Canadian has been removed from the United Nations Security Council's 1267 terrorist blacklist after facing years of persecution. The blacklist sanctions people and entities suspected of alleged associations with Al-Qaeda. Listing can occur without any crime being committed. FSRN's Lillian Bachter has more from Montreal.
Abu Sufyan Abdelrasik is a single father, raising two children on his own. In 2003, he was imprisoned in Sudan at the request of the Canadian spy agency. He was tortured and kept in forced exile for 6 years due to the Canadian government labeling him a national security risk and his presence on the UN 1267 list. No charges were ever laid against him in a criminal court, and the Canadian government eventually cleared his name. But since returning to Montreal in 2009, he has been living under severe restrictions, has been unable to work, and has had his assets frozen due to the UN 1267 list. Abdelrasik's lawyer, Paul Champ, says Abdelrasik's name was placed on the list because of information obtained through torture. Champ credits a victory to the Canadian public for bringing awareness to the issue. He says the Security Council also wants to avoid criticism by Canadian courts.
Many mistakes were made, and as a result, his life is ruined. He should be compensated for that.
Abdelrasik is continuing forward with his lawsuit against the Government of Canada for an apology and compensation. Lillian Bachter, FSRN, Montreal.
In Mali, around 600 police officers protested this week, sounding the horns of their scooters and cars on the highways in the capital, Bamako, and causing huge traffic jams in the city. Amadou Timbene reports for FSRN.
Police say they need new uniforms and other equipment, such as vehicles, so they can do their job correctly. They also want the government to stop firing or intimidating union members across the country. Sirimam Fani is a staff sergeant and the deputy secretary general of the Mali National Police Union.
Notre ministre de la Sécurité intérieure et de la Protection civile est en train de...
The Minister of Interior Security and Civil Protection has been giving money to some police officers in order to divide our union. That's the reason why we are demanding his resignation. We want another minister to be appointed to take care of our claims. The reduction of our salary has a negative impact on our daily life, purchase power, and morale. We are not going to stop our actions until our demands are fully met.
Police officers stopped work for several hours on Wednesday. They are also angry about a mandatory medical insurance policy implemented by Mali government 2 years ago. The union says public hospitals in the country are poorly equipped and doctors are not able to provide them appropriate health care. Amadou Tembine, FSRN, Bamako.
A controversial natural gas pipeline in Puerto Rico appears to be headed towards final approval after receiving a preliminary go-ahead from the Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps says it will not require the developer to submit an environmental impact statement for the project, according to the AP. The 90-mile-long proposed pipeline is slated to run through wetlands areas and is being opposed by several environmental groups. One, Casa Pueblo, released a report calling the project highly dangerous and saying that as many as 200,000 people could be put in harm's way. These fears have prompted locals to nickname the project El Gasoducto del Muerte, the pipeline of death. And finally, the unemployment rate in the U.S. has dropped to 8.6%, the lowest rate in more than 2 years. The Labor Department points to an overall improving economy. The so-called alternate unemployment rate, which includes those who have given up looking for work or are working part-time for economic reasons, fell as well. That figure dropped to 15.6% from 16.2% in October. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Welcome back to News 101. That was Free Speech Radio News. Thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. Up next, we have in our studio Professor Chris Erickson, who's a professor at the Political Science Department here at UBC. So, Professor, thanks for being on News 101.
Oh, thanks for having me on again, actually.
Yes, I mean, the last time you were on, it was October 17th.
Yes.
And the Occupy movement was well underway in the States, but in Vancouver, it just started October 15th, right?
Yes, it did.
And we can already see, like, a drastic change from, like, thousands of people outside the art gallery to just... flash occupiers.
Yes, that's true. I mean, with a movement like this, you kind of expect that it's going to change its face and it, yep. and its shape from time to time. There's really, that's not too much of a surprise that would be happening. It's interesting to see what kinds of new forms of expression it is taking. However, there doesn't seem to be a crystal clear direction, which is kind of par for the course with this movement. And as I mentioned before, perhaps one of its strengths. So we'll see where it goes from here. That's for sure.
Yeah, I remember last time we were talking about how this generated a discussion like never before, like in the media especially. I mean, we go through tons of articles. Our team goes through tons of articles. You know, every time we do our show, and I've seen like a surge in articles referring to Occupy and referring to the ideas that have been generated. So what do you think about this change in, I guess what you could call it, groupthink?
Yeah. I think that this is certainly it's striking a topic that people, I think, want to talk about, and in part because they don't quite know how to talk about it. We had mentioned this before that I've been looking at some of these responses myself, and what's interesting is that you might make the case that the Occupy movement is itself, I don't know if this is the right word, but it's empty. And this doesn't mean that it has no point or that it's ineffectual. What it means is that it is something like the abyss that stares back into you. So if you look at it, what I'm seeing is, in a lot of cases, the responses to the movement reflect more of the assumptions of the responder than anything about the movement itself. This is particularly the case. I remember watching an interview with a law professor out of New York. I think it was on Fox News a number of weeks ago now. And her opinion was that the Occupy movement would have no choice but to get violent. And given recent turns in what's been happening with some of the Occupy movement, it's interesting that in a way she was right, but I don't know if it's the movement itself that's become violent. I think it's more of a reflection of the assumptions that are going into the people that are responding to it. In a way, the movement becomes, again, this mirror reflection of your own view of the world. Almost like, I'm not a psychologist, but it's almost like a psychological projection. Well, if I was in this situation, I'd be getting violent, so I better stop them from getting violent, kind of a thing. And I'll do it through violence, of course. It becomes this really interesting sort of cycle. And it's really interesting to watch it. I mean, there's only so many times that you can sit and watch. I was watching some of the footage out of UC Davis recently. And, you know, Officer Pike walking casually up and down this row of protesters, you know, that are just sitting there and opening up with his bottle of pepper spray.
Yeah.
Some of the other footage from again, UC Davis, lines of students standing. It was just literally standing in a courtyard, and you can see the police kind of look around sort of nervously before starting to bludgeon people. It's like, wait a minute, where did that come from? And it's, I suppose, not all that surprising to see it.
Probably. I mean, this level of police brutality is strange to our generation, at the very least.
Yeah, it's something that you read about in your history books. You know, this might have happened
in
the 60s,
like those
right?
G20 but protests.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is that the rhetoric of, most popular rhetoric essentially assumes for itself the role of the peacekeeper. And so anything that opposes that system is automatically a disruption of the peace. If we're peaceful, they're violent. If we're rational, they're irrational, sort of a thing.
Right.
And there doesn't seem to be much recognition that there could be a rational opposition, just a different rationality. And I think that's something that certainly a lot of pundits are struggling with at this point to make sense of.
I'm going to jump in this for a second as well. I just want to hear your opinion on, do you think the reason the both the government and police response to Occupy Wall Street has been because it is this like empty movement that you're calling it? I mean, not like empty in a bad way, but like because it's so broad and it can't be pigeonholed, so they don't know how to respond to something if they can't pigeonhole it.
Yes. I think that that's it. And the fact that they can't pigeonhole it demonstrates that it really doesn't fit their particular view of the world. It always has struck me, and during the last interview I mentioned this, that there was a lot of pressure on the movement to declare its position.
Mm-hmm.
And that really didn't happen then. It's not happening now particularly, even though the insistence is still there. You can't get anything done unless you declare your position. And what struck me as odd over the last couple of months is that when you look at the groups and the organizations that do have very clear declared positions, I'll use the American example of the Republicans, the Democrats, the Tea Party, they all have very clear positions and they're getting nothing done because they're now in total gridlock.
Yeah.
And so to declare your position is in a way to declare any challenge totally moot. It's just to enter the gridlock.
Right. I remember last time you were talking about how if you're with me, that you have nothing to say.
Yes.
And if you're against me, well, we shouldn't talk.
Yeah, then we don't have anything to talk about.
Yeah.
yes, and so this is, I mean, you still see elements of this. And I think that what the system, just by chance, I've been reading some Fanon recently, The Wretched of the Earth. And granted, he's talking about the decolonization movement, but surprisingly, a lot of what he says speaks very much to what's going on right now, the use of violence and how, again, the system itself is going to declare itself the peacekeeper, and therefore anybody that is opposed to it in any way, shape, or form is violent.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a long history of this kind of thing, you know, firearms and
you can go back
ICBMs
to Guy Fawkes
being called peacekeepers.
Yeah. Right?
Yes, there's a lot of this kind of history.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting when you look at how, particularly in the United States, but not just in the United States, the militarization of police forces. It's not surprising to see this kind of violence come to the surface. I mean, the system itself, the way that I understand it, always has been violent, but it's cloaked itself in a language of peacefulness. And I mean, if you're going to have a violent system, then say, yeah, it's a violent system. And then the only issue with that is that then you open that up for discussion. If you say that this is a peaceful system and you cover it up, then any opposition to it is automatically violent. And so, that's why this notion of projecting onto the other that which you want to deny about yourself just makes it really difficult to challenge it. And I think that the Occupy movement, by not taking a stance, forces everybody else to show their hand. And we're starting to see some of the effects of that. When people get frustrated in the system as it stands, they get violent. And, it doesn't matter who you are, but if somebody knocks you over with the end of a billy club, you're not going to be happy when you get up.
Yeah.
And so who's violent in that situation? When is violence an acceptable response? I don't know where that line is. I hesitate to draw it too soon, that is for sure.
Speaking of the protests in Davis, I mean, there's one thing I do not understand, and that is that at what point does the system think that it's okay to mace students who are sitting down? I mean, how is that ever mm-hmm. justified within their minds as people, as human beings,
Yeah, I think that it's... It's a really difficult question. It's almost impossible to enter into the minds.
Yeah.
But at the same time, just even looking at the assumptions of the system, it's all about law and order, and I'm the law, and so you need to comply to what I say. There's really not much in the way of room for consideration of things that are outside of that structure, because the structure itself sees itself as totalizing. And so, and it can only see things in these binary terms.
Right.
And if there's something that comes and approaches that system without using these same binary terms, that says, "Well, I'm not red and I'm not blue," and then you go, "Yeah, but really, which one are you?"
Yeah.
Right.
and you have a shade of blue in there.
You have to be blue because you're not red, right? And then they say, "No, that's not the case." And that it leads to a sort of cognitive dissonance in a way, which is very stressful. And that stress gets released in violence. And besides, what's the point of having all these nice military goodies if you never get to use them?
Exactly.
There's simply that part of it. I am, that notion of I am the law. And I mentioned this in class today. It always reminds me of sort of the South Park, Cartman's respect my authority. but what good is that without the billy club?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and, I mean, speaking of that violence... Do you think that you mentioned that law professor in New York? Do you think she was saying that because do you think she's saying that because people are getting violent because they think the people responsible for implementing change are there's like a slight disconnection between what they know and the information that is out there. For example, that $7.7 trillion deal that the Federal Reserve Bank made with financial banks in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, that information just came out after that entire fiasco from 2008 up to now.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's information out there that's trickling out one at a time. And these are things that, because they're trickling out, not everybody's aware of.
Yeah.
And it is true that a majority of people who are sincerely involved with Occupy are aware of these mm-hmm. these things. So when people interact with such people, there's a big disconnection because the people who interact with do not know that information.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you have people who know things and you have people who do not know things, and when these things collide, you have words coming out like, "Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist," or mm-hmm. "Oh, you don't make any sense at all just because I don't know that piece of information."
Yes. Well, there's a long-standing political axiom that knowledge is power.
Right.
And in this day and age, information is power. And so to control flows of information is a form of power. There's no question about that. I think that to go back to sort of the initial observation, I honestly think that this particular I cannot remember her name, the law professor, I think she was saying this because she's thinking within the parameters of a system that doesn't know what else to do when it's frustrated but become violent.
Yeah.
And so she, again, projecting that assumption onto the Occupy movement. Well, if I can't think of anything else, neither can they, right?
That is also a binary submission and violence.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that ultimately is what this movement gives us at least pause to consider our assumptions on that very deep level. I mean, this sounds almost philosophical, but I think that it does present not just a political challenge, but a philosophical one. And it's one that we need to start thinking about, which is, you know, what if the world isn't just easy, you know, come in nice, easy binary boxes? Yeah. You know, what do we do then? And I think that that's something that the system as it stands now is very ill-suited to deal with. And yet I do think that it's a very pressing question. And it's not surprising that a system that finds itself under threat would find itself like essentially cornered. And when you corner something, it's not surprising if it turns violent. Just even the rhetoric itself is kind of interesting on this. The crowd control technique of kettling, right? It's cornering everybody in a small space. Right. Well, why are we surprised when we kettle a crowd that it boils?
Yeah.
Why is that shocking? And that's, again, that's something that I think we need to start taking a look at. I don't know if there are easy answers here. I don't think that there are. I think that there are deeper and deeper questions all the time. And I think when you look at what's happened with, say, Occupy Seattle, where the main sort of encampment was dismantled, but now it's become mobile and therefore much more difficult to track.
I did actually see them moving. I was in Seattle and I actually saw them moving.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, though, they got pepper sprayed really bad.
Without a doubt. Yes. And you get some really iconic images. The
84-year-old
grandmother being led away with the stuff dripping off of her face. You're just like, wow.
It looks like her face was melting off.
Yeah, you start thinking to yourself, whose system is this, actually?
Yes.
And I think that, again, this violent response is exposing the system more than the protesters, because in case after case after case, if you do a Google search for even simple terms like Occupy violence, most of what comes up are people saying, you know what, this was not the protesters that brought this on.
Yeah.
You know, this is the police that brought this on. And you start to question, well, who are the police? I mean, we have this with this idea. Now, I suppose especially in the United States, certain minority communities, this is not going to be a surprise that the police are not on your side.
Right.
For sort of mainstream white America that's now experiencing it, it's a shock.
Lawrence O'Donnell on his show, if you know Lawrence O'Donnell, he actually mentioned, he said something similar. He said that Black America, or I mean African-American America, was not surprised at this reaction at all. I mean, they experience it every day. You know, police brutality is part of their, I should say, culture. You know, and Lawrence said that this is something that white America is slowly becoming exposed to. And Occupy is bringing this up.
Well, I think it is bringing it very much to the forefront, which is, I mean, it wasn't. It's not good for anybody to be experiencing this kind of a
Absolutely
thing at all.
Not.
And it certainly doesn't match up with our own image of ourselves as sort of this freedom loving society and equality for everybody, and it doesn't match with that image whatsoever. And I think, again, that's the value of not taking a specific standpoint, is that it exposes these different things as much more hypocritical than they otherwise could have been exposed as. And the hypocrisy doesn't change anything, but it does certainly bring it more to the forefront so that it can be questioned more easily. I really think that seems to be the case. The other thing that strikes me is that I wonder that you know, something not quite right is going on when, you know, episodes of fistfights or drug overdoses or shootings or whatnot at an Occupy movement are grounds to completely shut it down. Whereas when those things happen at Walmart, it's competitive shopping.
Right. That was the strangest thing I've ever seen in my life.
This is really unusual.
That was spraying customers to get to the Xbox.
Yeah,
it was
absolutely
the strangest thing I'd ever seen.
The follow-up article that I read on that basically says that they're going to have a hard time proving that it was a criminal act because she may have just been defending herself.
And the strange thing was she actually walked out in that all that commotion, paid for the product, and left the
She bed. Walked out, paid, and left, yeah. And so it raises a whole bunch of questions. You know, why are... Maybe I'm just being, you know, sort of rhetorical here, but if those kinds of events leads to shutdown of Occupy movements, why are we not shutting down Walmarts?
Exactly.
And you know, again, I think it all it does is raises questions that we should probably address.
Well, for those of you tuning in, this was a discussion with Professor Chris Erickson, a political science professor here at UBC. Stay tuned. We will take a quick break and be right back, and I'll talk to him a bit more about how students at UBC are reacting to the Occupy movement.
All our CITR homies, we dedicate this shout-out to you for your support of our Fresh Beat.
You really knew what time it was during our 2011 fund drive, and we thank you, thank you, thank you for being so kind.
Big love and ups from your crew at CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. And until next year, remember to keep it real.
And I thank you,
said I thank you, yes I thank you,
and I thank you,
thank you, thank you,
and I want to thank you.
The mama thanks a million.
The music says it all, but we'd like to say it again. Thank you from all of us at CITR for your generous support during our 2011 fund drive. We just couldn't do it without you.
You made a million dreams come true, and so I'm saying thank you, a million to you.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. We shall now continue our discussion with Professor Chris Erickson. He's a political science professor here at UBC. So we've been talking about the Occupy movement, and we had quite a long discussion about the intricate binaries involved with the movement and the information, the hidden information that the movement brings up. And so, Professor, tell us about how your students in your classes have been reacting to this movement. I'm sure you've brought it up in class. I'm sure they have brought it up in class. So tell us, what do you think they have to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to speak for so many students all at once, but and certainly there's not going to be a universal agreement on this, nor should there be, for that matter. I teach this term. I'm teaching a political science, couple of sections of political science 100, which is kind of the intro level. And this has been a common theme since September. We've kind of looked at this, and I'm getting a variety of responses to it. Some people are very much like most people out there. They're kind of confused by it.
Yeah.
This is also something that I talk about in an upper-level course. And in that class, specifically, we are starting to question some of these binaries. We were doing this before the Occupy movement came about.
Right.
But we are starting to question some of those. And some of the feedback that I'm getting from there is really extremely interesting, simply because they're starting to learn the ability to view this for different frameworks. A lot of my first-year students... And I think this is fairly common, are trained to think that there are easy answers for everything. The way our educational system works right now is that you're trained to memorize and then, sort of spew it back and you do well. Yeah. And I think that kind of an approach needs to be questioned. And so what I'm seeing in my first year classes particularly is there's somewhat of a reluctance to move away from those, well, what's the answer?
Yeah.
Right? Is this movement, is it really, is it red or is it blue?
Yeah.
Right?
They've been taught to do that in high school.
Absolutely.
So what else
absolutely.
Do you expect?
Yeah. At the same time, you start seeing cracks in that, which is really nice. People say, hey, wait a minute, what is that anything like this? And they start drawing connections to a variety of other things that are happening. And that's really, I like seeing that. I like seeing that. Again, I think that in terms of responding to this, I don't think that there is a right way to respond, like not one right way to respond to this. I think it sets the stage for a huge number of questions. Yes, you've got practical questions of where does it go from here? What kind of policies come out of this? What kind of an effect does it have on actual legislation?
Some of them might even have suggestions as to what should be done.
Yes, and they should be able to vocalize those. The question of could we see a technological revision of direct democracy through cell phones and social media and the like.
Right.
That's certainly a point of discussion. And again, I think that we have some deeper questions, philosophical questions to ask that this kind of presents about, you know, the simple binaries that we're so used to, you know, viewing the world through.
Yeah.
And I think that set of lenses at this point is kind of failing us in a variety of ways. And not, I mean, the Occupy movement is simply one expression of that. I think that if there is going to be a response to the Occupy movement, I think that if it calls for a response, what it calls for is a highly imaginative one, one that is willing to question at the very presumptions of where your thought even starts. And that's not an easy thing to do. That is not an easy thing to do, because this history of thinking in binaries is very long. You know, it's not, we like to think of it as natural, but it's not really. It's got a, you know, it's its own genealogy. It has its own family tree. It has its own, you know, here's where it came from. But that doesn't make it any less difficult to unlearn. Yeah. It can be very hard. So, yeah.
I was wondering if, on the same vein as what you kind of, or at least what you've kind of measured from your students, uh-huh. or at least this, like, generation of kids, was, I mean, Occupy is something that people in our generation have never really seen before.
Yes.
Like, anything like it. I mean, 90s were a very peaceful, prosperous time for a lot of us, and now we see this, but we also see the recession.
Yeah.
And the recession is something that no one, like, a lot of us have never experienced a recession like this, you know? We've never had to deal with our jobs being at risk. We've grown up thinking that, you know, you go to university, you get a job, and it's fine, but now yeah. there's these powers outside of your control making it that you can't do that, no matter how hard you try. So, like, you're talking about how students are viewing Occupy. How are they viewing the recession and this whole, like, downturn of society? Not downturn of society, mm-hmm. but, like, this, like, kind of yeah. turn in events that no one saw coming.
Apocalyptic recession.
Yeah. No, well, I think one of the things that I do see more and more in students is an element of cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
And which is unfortunate, because cynicism, the way that I tend to look at that is it's a way of doing nothing and convincing yourself that you're doing something.
Yeah.
Cynicism is in a way a kind of a cop out. Mm-hmm. And to some extent I do see that. I try to discourage it wherever I can find it. Mm-hmm. Basically saying, look, we don't need to be cynical about this. We need to understand it. We need to figure out what our tools are and how assumptions about those tools may have led us into this corner.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to come out with a kind of a solution, doing more of the same thing probably is not going to be that solution.
Yeah.
And so how do you maintain take real stock of what is not an overly rosy picture and yet remain optimistic about the ability to make it into something better? And that's a real challenge. That's a real challenge, because I'm not the only, certainly I'm not the only voice. Well, I don't even know if they are listening to me, but
I made sure a couple of them are.
Well, that's good. That's good. I'm certainly not the only voice that's out there. There's a lot of other voices that are just mm-hmm. doom and gloom.
Yeah.
And again, how do you become an intelligent consumer of that information? Again, going back to this idea that information is power, how do you become an intelligent consumer of that information? Mm-hmm. How do you say, well, do I buy that or do I not?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, maybe we're shifting away from the Occupy movement in particular, but I tend to think that that is what's needed in our educational systems, and the Occupy movement is yet another expression of the need. Mm-hmm. And it's not, certainly not the only one, but I think it's a very clear expression of the need to be able to think about things differently. We use this truism now, thinking outside the box, but that is an exceptionally difficult thing to do, simply because the box keeps reasserting itself.
Yeah.
And so you've got to understand what the parameters of the box are in order to think outside of it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think we need, like, the challenges of the Occupy movement, and there are many, they're varied, there's lots of them. I think what we need to do is look at them and look at them closely. I mean, with this $7 trillion sort of issue, I caught maybe 10 seconds of that today. This is the first I saw of it. But I think it was Dennis Kucinich that said, you know, now do you see what the Occupy movement is all about?
Okay. Was that with the Federal Reserve?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
11 times more than the $700 billion of the TARP game.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, the Federal Reserve is kind of supposed to... Well, I mean, I'm not going to get into that right now.
But at an interest rate of 0.01%.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
I mean, like, the reason... Actually, that's completely off subject. I'm not going to get into that. But getting back to kind of the info wars you guys are talking about, you know, this is like when you have this sort of non-violent protest,
mm-hmm.
there's really, you can't find a tangible victory, you know, there's no like, we've gained this much ground, we got some change, it's trying to, you know, fight for the like hearts and minds of people.
Yeah.
So it is all about spin, it's all about InfoWars, and like, how do you think the mainstream is reacting to that? Because, I mean, in the last 5 years alone, we've seen the five, maybe like 7-10 years, that the way information change, like travels, has changed dramatically with
yes.
social media, and that has worked so much in the occupiers' favor.
Yes, it has.
Yeah, and so do you think that the whole, a lot of the violence that's coming out on the police side, that they don't know how to control that, because you can't, you're fighting against intangibility.
Exactly.
You know?
It's that kind of, that kind of level of communication and ability to organize actually bypasses the systems that are in place for controlling mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And so the system that is now bypassed has to reassert itself, and it does so, well, violently. It says, look, I still matter, when maybe there's a case for saying that it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's precisely why we're seeing this kind of increase. It doesn't know how else to deal with the situation, so it mm-hmm. clamps down. And I think that that's more or less what we're seeing. But again, that's an indictment of the system itself, not really an indictment of the people that are challenging it.
Right. Well, Professor Erickson, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks again. Appreciate it.
We'll make sure you are back to talk to us when the world goes to hell.
Yeah, there we go.
And that'll be sometime, like, I'm guessing July, summer of 2012. When everybody's in Hawaii and then everything collapses. All right, so that's our program for December 2nd, 2011. Today's news.